Picture a dusty military range in Germany. A young cavalry specialist lines up shot after shot, hitting targets with precision that makes his commanding officer beam with pride. In that moment of pure excellence, the soldier can't contain himself. America is f***ing awesome! That raw, unfiltered pride captures something we've lost in our carefully sanitized political discourse. The unapologetic belief that America, for all its flaws, represents something worth defending. This wasn't just a soldier's enthusiasm, it became a guiding philosophy for navigating 4 years at the highest levels of American power during a period marked by impeachment battles, global pandemics, and unprecedented political turbulence. The question wasn't whether America deserved defending, it was whether our leaders had the courage to do so without constantly apologizing for our existence. Think about the last time you avoided a difficult conversation because it might make things uncomfortable. Now imagine making that avoidance your entire foreign policy. That's essentially what happened to American diplomacy before 2017. We'd become so afraid of upsetting anyone that we stopped standing for anything. North Korea built nukes while we wrung our hands. China stole intellectual property while we filed polite complaints. Russia seized Crimea while we issued strongly worded statements. The pattern was clear. When you're afraid to risk anything, you end up losing everything. Transforming the CIA meant confronting risk-averse culture head-on. The previous leadership had hired McKinsey & Co., yes, the same consulting firm that counts the Chinese Communist Party as a client, to reorganize America's premier intelligence agency. The result was predictably bureaucratic. Rainbow lanyards replaced risky operations, diversity metrics overshadowed intelligence gathering, and climate change somehow became a top priority for spies. Real intelligence work requires people willing to operate in moral gray zones and make split-second decisions with incomplete information. By bringing in operators like Gina Haspel, a 30-year clandestine service veteran, the message was clear: we're back in the espionage business. When Israel's Mossad needed urgent extraction after a critical mission, Israeli operatives were in safe houses within 24 hours and home within 48. That's what happens when you stop treating every decision like it might end your career. Every organization has two types of people: those who make things happen and those who explain why things can't happen. The term pipe hitter, someone focused relentlessly on winning with excellence and determination, became the standard. At the CIA, this meant slashing paperwork requirements by 40 to 70% and empowering the Special Activities Division by changing their rules of engagement. The State Department needed similar cultural overhaul. The Swagger campaign wasn't about arrogance, it was about pride. When you represent the United States abroad, every interaction should leave people impressed by American competence, confidence, and values. This required creating the ethos, a professional code emphasizing professionalism, integrity, and accountability. But constant turnover destroys everything you build. 4 secretaries of defense, 4 national security advisors, 4 chiefs of staff. Each transition meant months of bringing new people up to speed and signaling instability to adversaries. The worst offender was John Bolton, who deliberately sabotaged North Korea negotiations by invoking the Libya model on television, terminology guaranteed to remind Kim Jong-un of Gaddafi's gruesome end. Foreign policy requires working with imperfect partners. Saudi Arabia isn't a liberal democracy, but it counterbalances Iranian expansion and stabilizes global energy markets. When Saudi agents murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018, the media demanded we treat them as a pariah state. Should one horrific murder, which we condemned and sanctioned, override decades of strategic partnership? The Obama administration's Iran nuclear deal gave Tehran sanctions relief that funded terrorism while merely delaying their nuclear ambitions. Reimposing maximum pressure wasn't warmongering. It was understanding that appeasing bad actors encourages worse behavior. Appeasement resembles alcohol addiction. It feels like it solves your immediate problem while ensuring bigger problems later. Jihadis, Beijing communists, Putin-style thugs, Iranian theocrats, they interpret concessions as weakness to exploit, not goodwill to reciprocate. When Iran-backed militias killed American contractor Narez Hamid, the decision point arrived: respond decisively or watch deterrence collapse. Qassem Soleimani, the Quds Force commander who directed operations killing over 600 American troops, was traveling between Beirut, Damascus, and Baghdad, plotting more attacks. As his sedan left Baghdad airport, Hellfire missiles struck with deadly precision. Democrats predicted catastrophe. Biden called it hugely escalatory. Instead, the bold action restored deterrence and sent unmistakable messages to adversaries worldwide. Sometimes the only way to prevent war is demonstrating willingness to fight. When Putin tried keeping a visitor waiting 30 minutes, the response was simple: prepare to leave. His staff scrambled to begin the meeting within minutes. This wasn't petty, it was essential. Dictators probe constantly for weakness, and any concession signals vulnerability. Putin, a former KGB agent who views the Soviet collapse as the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century, has spent two decades rebuilding Russian power. He annexed Crimea after Obama failed to enforce his Syria red line, correctly calculating that American threats were empty. He responds only to clear boundaries backed by credible force. The Russia investigation constrained American diplomacy, making boundary setting nearly impossible without triggering collusion accusations. Yet, relationships could still be built. During a Moscow meeting with Russian intelligence chiefs, the gift was provocative: DVDs of Rocky IV, The Hunt for Red October, and Miracle on Ice, American movies where we defeat Russians. The message: we're not here to make friends, but we can work together when interests align. When CIA intelligence helped Russia thwart an ISIS plot targeting St. Petersburg's Kazan Cathedral, Putin personally called to express gratitude. The strongest evidence of effective Russia policy? Putin didn't invade Ukraine during those 4 years. What he faced was a rebuilt American military, more troops in Europe, a stronger NATO, withdrawal from the INF Treaty, and lower energy prices devastating Russia's fossil fuel-dependent economy. He waited until a new administration took office, timing that speaks volumes about deterrence. America First reasserted that American leaders serve American citizens, not global institutions. Alexander Hamilton warned against showing kindness or humanity toward others to the prejudice of their constituents. Yet post-Cold War leaders did exactly that through harmful trade agreements and submission to overreaching international organizations. The asylum system made a mockery of legal immigration. The Remain in Mexico policy used existing statutory authority to fix this. When Mexican Foreign Secretary Marcelo Ebrard resisted, the ultimatum was simple: implement within 14 days or face complete border closure. Mexico agreed, and the policy worked magnificently. The Paris Agreement would have cost the U.S. economy $3 trillion and 6.5 million jobs while allowing China to increase emissions until 2030. The UN Human Rights Council included violators like China and Venezuela while disproportionately criticizing Israel. The International Criminal Court investigated U.S. personnel from Afghanistan, a direct assault on sovereignty. Visa bans and asset freezes on ICC officials followed, and by 2020, ICC staff declined to work on the case. Despite media narratives about isolationism, coalition building continued. By October 2020, more than 30 nations, representing 1.6 billion people, signed the Geneva Consensus Declaration, affirming there is no international right to abortion and upholding national sovereignty. Sovereignty doesn't mean isolation. It means making decisions based on American values and interests rather than international pressure. The Chinese Communist Party isn't just another government. It's an ideological movement, viewing itself as the vanguard of international communism, seeking to undermine capitalist states like America. Xi Jinping holds a doctorate in Marxist-Leninist theory and genuinely believes the East is rising and the West is declining. For decades, Western engagement assumed economic liberalization would lead to political liberalization. We were catastrophically wrong. the CCP viewed the Soviet collapse as betrayal of Marxist-Leninist ideals. While we congratulated ourselves on bringing China into the global economy, they quietly built power, stole intellectual property, and conditioned influential Americans to support their rise. Meeting Xi Jinping revealed the stark difference between the Chinese people and their oppressive regime. Xi was dour and dead-eyed, a quintessential communist apparatchik, contrasting sharply with creative, entrepreneurial Chinese citizens. The telecommunications battle illustrates what's at stake. The Clean Network Initiative convinced 60 countries to reject Huawei. Combined with commerce restrictions, this crushed Huawei's business. Handset shipments plummeted 81% from 2020 to 2021. Coordinated speeches from top national security officials declared that securing our freedom from the CCP is the mission of our time. The choice is simple: defend freedom now or watch it erode until defending it becomes impossible. The Abraham Accords succeeded by rejecting the failed assumption that Israeli-Palestinian peace must precede Middle East progress. MBZ of the UAE, a staunch opponent of Islamism who championed Western ideas, recognized Iranian power as a greater threat than ritualistic hostility toward Israel. The relationship was built on straight talk and kept promises, not empty diplomatic niceties. After the UAE's August 2020 announcement, Bahrain joined within 29 days, followed by Sudan and Morocco. Israeli and Emirati fighter pilots now fly in formation rather than combat. We came remarkably close to bringing Saudi Arabia into the Accords, no small feat given their custodianship of Mecca and Medina. Future expansion requires four conditions: acknowledging Israel's right to exist, American leadership, unwavering U.S.-Israel alliance, and American willingness to defend members from Iranian threats. The Accords proved Middle East peace doesn't require solving every historical grievance first. It requires leaders brave enough to prioritize their people's future over ancient hatreds.